is African News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on African News Tonight.
But I can tell you, until Kenyans and the world is better, the country is so safe. We've put in measures in place. Yeah, we've populated, all the mega towns and critical areas with our security. Our security guys are very alert under the ground.
That's Kenya's police spokesman, Bruno Shioso, on a terror alert from France on a possible attack this weekend in Nairobi. Details coming up. Also, the U.S. has voiced alarm at renewed fighting by Tigrayan rebels in Ethiopia's Afar region. These stories and more on African News Tonight. We start with our top story. Reuters cited two diplomatic sources as saying ECOWAS today suspended Burkina Faso from its governing bodies in response to this week's military coup and decided to send a delegation to the capital, Ouagadougou. It was not immediately clear what other sanctions the 15-member grouping of West African countries might have decided to impose during an emergency virtual summit. ECOWAS has imposed a range of sanctions on Mali and Guinea over the past 18 months in response to military takeovers. The French embassy in Kenya has issued a terror alert to Western nationals, urging them to avoid places this weekend where foreigners gather, such as hotels and shopping centers, especially in the capital, Nairobi. The German embassy sent the country's citizens a less specific terror alert, urging caution. Kenyan police say they have seen the terror alert and have beeped up security. Mohamed Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
Kenyan authorities say they have deployed enough security to respond to any planned terror attack in the country. This step comes as France issued a terror alert and warned its citizens against visiting shopping malls and hotels, especially in the capital, Nairobi. Kenya's police spokesman, Bruno Shioso, told VOA they saw the alert on social media and there was no need to fear.
I can't really comment about that, but what I can tell you, until Kenyans and the world, is that the country is so safe. We've put in measures in place. Yeah, we've populated, all the mega towns and critical areas with our security. Our security guys are very alert under the ground, so there should be no need for fear.
In 2013, Al-Shabaab militants stormed the Westgate Mall in Nairobi, killing more than 60 people. Another attack by the Somali terrorist group on the Dusit Hotel 3 years ago killed 21. Hassan Khananji is the head of the Horn Institute for Strategic Studies. He says Kenya and other countries must work together to combat any security threats to the East African nation.
I think it is important because the terror problem is an international problem that, foreign countries with, for instance, missions in Nairobi or with countries in the region are able to work out with their local counterparts, either to preempt or at least to be able to approach it in a more coordinated fashion, because one of the challenges in fighting terror has been poor coordination among the key stakeholders, and that includes governments.
The Horn of Africa is facing both political and security challenges. The Ethiopian government is involved in a war with its north and Tigray region. Somalia faces a political crisis that emanates from the delayed elections, and Kenya is preparing for general elections in August. Khananji says the region needs to be on high alert to deal with those who want to benefit from its political volatility.
This year is going to be very critical for the region in trying to manage those threats, because the challenge that the region has faced, not just Kenya, is the moment there isn't a massive attack, then the people tend to become complacent and government's response also tends to become a little bit complacent. And so this calls us to attention that I think as stakeholders and people who care about peace, peaceful citizens of the region should actually be more vigilant with regard to potential exploitation of the confusion or relative chaos that exists in the region today.
Since the beginning of this year, Kenyan security agencies have reported several attacks against people in Lamu County, which borders Somalia. On Wednesday, suspected Al-Shabaab fighters in Lamu sprayed a convoy carrying judicial officials with bullets, injuring several people. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
According to the French news agency AFP, the United States has voiced alarm at renewed fighting by Tigrayan rebels in Ethiopia's Afar region. State Department spokesman Ned Price says the fighting is very concerning. He urged all actors to cease all offensive operations, which also hinders crucial humanitarian access. On the other hand, the U.S. has welcomed a push by Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed's government to shorten a state of emergency imposed last November when rebels seemed poised to threaten the capital. In a bid to replace interim Prime Minister Abdul Hamid Dbeibah, Libya's eastern-based parliament published a list of 13 criteria for candidates to govern the country. They include a commitment not to run in future elections and the backing of at least 25 deputies. Dbeibah has repeatedly said he will only hand power to an elected government. William Lawrence, professor of political science at the American University in Washington, discussed with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi the complicated political situation in Libya.
The House of Representatives, the HOR, has very little legitimacy and not much to contribute into this discussion. It's a rump parliament left over from the 2014 elections that caused the six-year civil war. And it was partially empowered by the 2015 Libya political agreement, but it was discredited when it backed the assault by General Haftar on Tripoli in 2019-2020. And one of the mistakes of the last UN Libya envoy, Kubish, is that he took some HOR advice on the elections. And it was one of the reasons the December 24th elections had to be postponed, because the UN had for a moment deferred to that parliament, which is really more of a partisan operation than representative of anything. The HOR is more or less the mouthpiece of presidential candidate Aguila Saleh. So anything it says has to be run through the filter of his preferences for the elections. So the government of Libya is actually, it's called the Government of National Unity, the GNU. And that was created by a UN body put together called the Libyan Political Dialogue Forum, the LPDF. And they just said he's trying to create discord and friction prior to the elections. Now, the current prime minister, Dbeibah, who you mentioned, who he wants to replace, he was selected by this UN body that was put together by Stephanie Williams, the UN envoy. So Dbeibah would never agree to step down unless elections happen and I'm replaced by an elected body. So then this decision can just be ignored, and the poison pill they're dishing up, you know, won't sabotage the elections.
The UN also called for a new date for the presidential ballot rather than a government reshuffle. United Kingdom's embassy in Tripoli has said that London continues to recognize the government of national unity and does not endorse the establishment of parallel governments or institutions. What is the way out of this conflicting positions?
The solution is do exactly what Dbeibah, the UN, and the UK embassy said. And that's also the position of the United States and all of the other European countries and Middle Eastern countries involved in the Berlin process. Dbeibah is the most popular politician in the country by far. So if his rivals say he needs to step down, that's not a mandate to step down. Spoilers can't delay the elections and then say, because we can't have elections, we get to choose who would have been in the jobs that those elections would have selected someone for. And there's no question of a reshuffle here, unless Dbeibah wants a cabinet reshuffle through the UN process, but not the rump Eastern Parliament that attacked the Western part of the country where most of the people live. There's no need for a parallel government. There's no need for an interim government. There's no need for an unelected government with new conditions placed down by the Eastern Parliament. So Dbeibah's right. The only solution here is free and fair elections.
Russia and the United States were deadlocked Thursday over extending the UN mission in Libya, which ends January 31st, with Moscow demanding the Secretary General's American Special Advisor on Libya, Williams, to be replaced, and also proposing extending the mission until April 30th only. Would such a division in the United Nations Security Council complicate the situation in Libya?
Yes. Russia backed one side in this long war through Wagner mercenaries, and that side lost in the war. So then we had a ceasefire and the Berlin process. Then the Russians backed a Slovakian envoy who was a disaster. He was the one that made the mistake of bowing to the Eastern rump parliament's conditions for the elections. Then the UN said, okay, we're going to bring back the previous acting envoy, Williams, and gave her all the responsibilities of the envoy and called her a special advisor. Williams was the most successful envoy of the seven we've seen since the UN mission was created. So, you know, either the Russians will be shamed into extending the mission, and now they want to, of course, stop the mission until 2 months before the elections. That doesn't make sense. You know, or Guterres will just find a way with 14 members of the Security Council to come with a formula to move Libya ahead politically, even if Russia plays hardball.
That was William Lawrence, professor of political science at the American University in Washington, speaking with my colleague Mohamed Al-Shinawi. Fighting has gone on since Tuesday in the eastern DRC between government troops and members of the group known as the M23. The M23 says the government attacked them and that the Kinshasa government has yet to fulfill agreement to reintegrate the group's members into society. Reporter Jafar Al-Katanti in Goma spoke with VOA's Kate Bond-Dawson about what is happening.
Since 3 days now, there is a fighting between some M23 elements and the FRDC. And this, we can say, is the fifth time of this fighting since October. On the fourth time, M23 was not accepting, but yesterday their spokesperson accepted that it's them and they are not the one who started fighting, but they received shots from FRDC and they have to respond for their defense.
In the previous clashes, M23 denied they were involved. This time they are saying they are involved, but it was defensive. Where is the fighting going on?
It's somewhere in Rutshuru, called in around Rugari village. And according to M23, they are there in that location since long time, some years ago. And they are not enemy. They are not attacking FRDC or locals. They are there waiting for the application of the agreement between them and the government so that they return in DRC peacefully. But according to their spokesperson, they don't understand how since October they receive attacks, many attacks from FRDC troops. That's why they decided to reply defending.
Now, tell our listeners a little bit about who the M23 is.
M23 is a local militia supported, early supported by Rwanda, but who occupied Goma in 2012, and then they left the city and they were defeated by FRDC. They went part in Rwanda and another part in Uganda. And after talking with the Congolese government, they signed an agreement which one allowed them to return back in DRC. But since the signature, nothing has been done.
That's journalist Jafar Al-Katanti in Goma, DRC. He spoke with my colleague a few hours ago. The M23 or March 23 movement began as a rebellion of troops in the Democratic Republic of Congo military more than 12 years ago. The movement was crushed after it occupied Goma a decade ago, but remnants have continued to operate, one of dozens of militant groups fighting for land and resources in the eastern DRC. France's Foreign Minister Yves Le Drian says the junta currently ruling Mali is out of control, implementing very restrictive measures. Given the rupture in the political and military framework, Le Drian says, we cannot continue like this. Yesterday, according to a Reuters report, France and 14 European countries urged the junta to allow Danish special forces to remain in Mali to fight Islamist militants. But today, Denmark said it was pulling out its troops because the junta insisted on an immediate withdrawal. Mali's military leaders have deployed private Russian military contractors recently to battle Islamist insurgents. Asked if European forces should remain in Mali, the French foreign minister said talks are being held with African and European partners to find ways to adapt forces so they can continue the fight against terrorism. The Atlanta-based Carter Center is making dramatic progress in the eradication of Guinea worm disease. VOA's Ken Farbo reports that if the remaining endemic countries in Africa, Chad, South Sudan, Mali, Ethiopia, and border areas of Cameroon rid the parasite completely, it would become the first disease in human history eradicated through prevention and not vaccination.
As he faced the world during a 2015 press conference, grappling with a potentially fatal cancer diagnosis, former U.S. President Jimmy Carter said he had one more goal to fulfill.
I'd like for the last guinea worm to die before I do.
Over 6 years later, Carter, now 97, has battled through brain cancer and other health setbacks to see his Carter Center mark a historic milestone in the fight to rid the world of the once-neglected tropical disease. The global nonprofit began dedicating resources to fighting in 1986.
We are pleased to mention that there are only 14 human cases in the world through the end of 2021, and no logs so far in 2022.
That's the lowest number of recorded cases in human history, says Adam Weiss, the director of the Carter Center's Guinea Worm Eradication Program. The milestone places the effort close to being only the second disease ever eradicated.
So every year, more than 3 million people were suffering from guinea worm. And today, to be able to say only 14 human beings on a planet of, what, almost 8 billion people is just remarkable.
Remarkable in part, says Weiss, because the 14 cases in 2021 is also a 48% drop from the previous year, a time when the world has been dealing with the coronavirus pandemic.
The national programs have remained almost entirely operational throughout the pandemic.
Weiss says much of the guinea worm eradication effort in endemic countries isn't staffed by foreign nationals, but instead relies on local villagers and community members to manage prevention efforts at local water sources.
We built a formidable force at the community level. We ensure that we have a program which is anchored within the structure of the community. And we work every day to ensure there is ownership at the community level.
McCoy Lagora is the director of the guinea worm eradication effort with the Ministry of Health in South Sudan, a country that at one point accounted for almost 80% of global infections. The effort to fight guinea worm prevailed over civil war and sporadic unrest in South Sudan to reach the point of only 4 recorded cases in 2021.
And I want to believe that if we can do it in South Sudan, it can be done everywhere.
Mali, Ethiopia, Chad, and parts of its border area with Cameroon are the last strongholds of guinea worm on the planet. But while the effort has mostly met success, it has also experienced setbacks.
What we've seen in the last 10 years or so is infections occurring in domestic animals. And so we did experience a setback to the global campaign in 2012 when we started to see that occurring.
But only a small number of cases were recorded in animals in 2021, and the fight against the worm seems to be nearing the finish line. As the number of guinea worm cases globally dwindles, President Carter's age advances. And Adam Weiss says everyone involved in the effort would like to see the goal of zero cases reached soon.
Of course, I would like nothing more than to see it happen in his lifetime. You know, President Carter, as our big boss, but also as our North Star in trying to help keep us focused, it adds a layer of pressure and also a layer of responsibility that we all have.
Kane Fairbaum, VOA News, Chicago.
The South African government's considering an application by national energy company Eskom to raise electricity rates by more than 20%. Eskom says South Africa's energy crisis will deepen if it does not get more money fast. Africa's most industrial economy has been suffering blackouts for 15 years. One reason is that Eskom's old coal-fired power stations have not been properly maintained. Darren Taylor reports.
A commission of inquiry has found the chaos at Eskom was caused by the African National Congress administration of Jacob Zuma. It says the former president appointed cronies to plunder the utility. As a result, says Eskom's chief financial officer, Caleb Kassim, it's drowning in debt.
If we're not recovering it through the electricity tariff, our only option then is to approach the shareholder and government to then help deal with the shortfall.
Cape Town, a city governed by the opposition Democratic Alliance, is opposing Eskom's request. Its mayor is Jordan Hill Lewis.
The Eskom doesn't ask government for help. It asks you and me, and boy, have we given it help. We've given it 150 billion rand in bailouts over the last decade. We have paid 307% before this increase in higher prices over the last decade. And it still doesn't work. It is still deep in debt. It hasn't cut costs. And it doesn't.
According to the latest government statistics, only about 12 million people out of a population of 60 million can be placed within the bracket of middle class. These are the ones who bear the brunt of soaring energy costs, says Hill Lewis. The poor majority, although expected to pay for electricity, generally don't, simply defaulting on tariffs or using illegal connections. Kassim says it's largely because so few people pay for power that Eskom's constantly forced to raise prices.
We understand the economic circumstances that is facing the country and the economy, but at the end of the day, government has already given us a large amount of equity injections in the recent past, 56 billion, 49 billion, and 32 billion this year, including 21 billion for the next financial year and 20 billion thereafter.
Hill Lewis says Eskom managers rattle off these numbers as if they're nothing. Yet all of this money comes from the pockets of a tiny tax base, expected to fund a company that can't keep the lights on and is nearly bankrupt and obsolete.
You can't keep going to the public to save Eskom, which is in this position not by the fault of the public, but because of mismanagement, corruption, far too much debt too quickly over the course of the last...
But Kassim says no matter what happens, South Africans, already burdened by economic depression worsened by the COVID-19 pandemic, will soon be paying much more to cook, clean, and watch TV.
And ultimately, you need to choose between whether you pay for electricity directly as the consumer or indirectly as the taxpayer. And we understand...
Hill Lewis says it's this gun against the head approach from Eskom and the government that's angering him and many citizens.
We've got no other choice, do we? If this was an insurance company charging us like this, or if this was a local grocery store charging us like this, we would just go elsewhere.
But as he points out, that elsewhere doesn't exist at the moment because the government is intent on supporting Eskom's monopoly on supplying electricity. Instead of dissolving the company and allowing independent power producers to generate solar, wind, and water energy. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Cameroon has been far from convincing as it advanced through group and one round of the knockout stages. On the other hand, Gambia has thrilled with its attack approach and improbable run to the last eight of the Africa Cup of Nations tournament. Sunday, Cameroon and giant killer Gambia will be facing off. According to a Reuters report, elimination of host Cameroon at this stage would come as a blow to the tournament already hard hit by the death of eight spectators in a stadium stampede. Also on Sunday, Egypt will clash against Morocco and heavily favored Senegal will try to end the run for Equatorial Guinea. The quarterfinal winners will advance to the semifinals to be played on Wednesday and Thursday. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com.